She's one proud mother.
No way, no how, no McCain.
Hillary Clinton takes the convention stage to silence the doubters, the skeptics, and the holdouts. Hillary drops a Denver Obamlet. We're having politics for breakfast on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 27th, and look who's back. John Hockenberry is here.
And
hello, hello.
I'm eating Obamlet. You want some?
Sounds yummy.
Thank you, Adora.
We go to Denver today for reports from the Democratic National Convention in reaction to the much-anticipated speech of Senator Hillary Clinton. Also, as Republicans prepare for their convention next week, the legacy of President Bush is on the minds of many. And Hurricane Katrina, 3 years later, and some are still fighting to get home to the Gulf Coast. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
At the Democratic National Convention last night, Hillary Clinton got a standing ovation and was all about unity.
And whether you voted for me or you voted for Barack, the time is now to unite as a single party with a single purpose.
Clinton also used her time in the spotlight to blast John McCain. Bill Clinton takes the stage tonight, and Joe Biden will officially accept the party's nomination for vice president. The British Foreign Secretary David Miliband is visiting Ukraine today to try to assemble what he's called a coalition against Russian aggression in Georgia. Moscow provoked Western condemnation on Tuesday when it recognized two breakaway Georgian regions as independent states. The French foreign minister, Bernard Kouchner, has warned that another Russian objective could now be the mainly Russian-speaking region of the Crimea in Ukraine.
A U.S. embassy spokesman says a U.S. warship loaded with aid on its way to Georgia, the Georgia city of Poti, actually docked somewhere else. American officials haven't said why plans have changed. Top Russian military officials have said humanitarian supplies are not necessary. A Libyan official says the hijackers who took over a Sudanese plane after takeoff and forced it to land at a desert airstrip in Libya have released all of the nearly 100 passengers. The Boeing 737 was headed to the Sudanese capital.
In Thailand, riot police stormed the prime minister's office overnight. They're trying to eject anti-government protesters who took over the building yesterday. Demonstrators say they won't leave until Prime Minister Sumak Suntarvej steps down. He's accused of corruption. In politics, Barack Obama is talking with veterans and military families this morning in Billings, Montana. John McCain is taking the day off. Oil prices above $117 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow up 0.25% to 11,412, and the S&P is set to open at 1271.
You said omelet, so that means food.
I'm thinking about food. The BBC is tracking world food prices and says U.S. consumers have been paying over 5% more for their food. How do you track food prices? We want to make you a correspondent for your hometown. How has the price of your staple foods like bread and milk changed? That's a takeaway question today.
Yeah, and I think they have.
Oh, they have in many, many ways. And depending on where you are in the world, it's radically different. We're going to be talking about that. But we want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You want another bite of this omelet?
Yum.
Yum. It's got cheese in it.
And mushrooms, right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It may be my day one back here in the saddle, but it's day three at the Democratic National Convention, and it was all about Hillary Clinton. She had a chance to open old wounds or close a political chapter. It was all about unity. It could have been about vindication. Was it all of the above? None of the above? We go now to Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein, who's in Denver at the convention. Andrea, Hillary Clinton had an assignment last night. How did she do?
Hey, John. Well, her assignment was to gather together all of these people who have been walking around Denver saying, I don't know. I feel all my heartstrings being tugged by the presence of all these Hillary Clinton delegates. What if, what if, what if? So here's what happened last night. It was locked down in the convention center. Now, this usually doesn't happen until the nominee, him or herself, comes into the convention hall. But by about half an hour before the Hillary Clinton speech, the fire marshals were not letting anybody in or out of the hall. And there was every square inch was packed. And then on comes this video, a montage of Hillary Clinton's life. It was narrated by Chelsea Clinton. And the crowd was really whipped up into a frenzy by this video in which Chelsea Clinton was sort of talking about her mother and all her achievements and how she didn't get to become president, but the dream lives on. And everybody was up, and they were waving these white Hillary Clinton placards with the Hillary signature that we've all become so familiar with. And people's eyes were just misting over. And it must have been about 5 minutes of applause before she could even get a word in.
Wow. I mean, they certainly were planning to work this crowd into an emotional frenzy, but I gather even the voltage there surprised you a little bit.
Yeah, it did. It was very high. And I think that there was, I mean, you know, it's a sort of divided crowd, lots of Hillary Clinton delegates, but more Barack Obama delegates. And I think they were very worried that it might not be a great speech, or that she'd be giving with one hand and taking away with another. There were some people who thought that's what happened, but for the most part, she just went right in there. She said, "I am for President Barack Obama," and she went right to those supporters who are holding out and said, "Listen, guys and gals," whom she referred to at one point as the sisterhood of the traveling pantsuit, you should take this to heart, what I am saying. And this is how she laid it out.
I haven't spent the past 35 years in the trenches, advocating for children, campaigning for universal health care, helping parents balance work and family, and fighting for women's rights here at home and around the world, to see another Republican in the White House squander our promise of a country that really fulfills the hopes of our people.
And that is the case she's been making since she got to Denver on Monday, but it's been building to a crescendo. And yesterday I was speaking with her senior campaign advisor, Ann Lewis, and she said, some people just need to hear it for themselves. Last night, a lot of people did.
Well, you know, it also is an echo of what Senator Kennedy was saying. I'm going to be there to work with Barack Obama. I mean, you see the Democrats assembling a team post-inauguration.
Right. And then, you know, she picks up on that in her speech when she was saying, you know, this isn't about me, the person, which is something that I found so much in the swing states, that they were voting for her because of their personal connection. And she went right to that and she said, this isn't about me, Hillary Clinton. This is about all the issues that we've been fighting for. And she gets very directly to it right here.
I want you to ask yourselves, were you in this campaign just for me? Or were you in it for that young Marine and others like him? Were you in it for that mom struggling with cancer while raising her kids? Were you in it for that young boy and his mom surviving on the minimum wage? Were you in it for all the people in this country who feel invisible?
And the people who feel invisible, that was the sort of troubadours for Hillary Clinton in this campaign. She's been talking about them forever, but when she talked about them last night, she was really sort of trying to hit that pitch of, you need to turn around your vote for me and make it for Barack Obama.
Well, rhetorically, she pushes them away from her, but in the hall, when the cameras would move to the crowds, it was bonding them closer to her. I thought that was pretty effective as a speech.
It was kind of two things happening at once, because they were holding up their white Hillary Clinton signs, but they were also holding up these blue signs that kind of reflected the state signs that you see on the convention floor. And they said Obama-Clinton unity. And, you know, of course, all of this is choreographed. So right before the speech, these volunteers come out with these big black plastic bags and they hand them out and people start holding them up. But people were sort of shaking them vehemently, because what she was doing was she was sort of creating the bridge that some of these people needed to get to her. And then she did something that people sort of had begun to complain about on the first night, which is she really just threw out the red meat on John McCain. And she set it up by saying, he's my colleague, he's my friend, but he's not the person that we need in the White House.
John McCain says the economy is fundamentally sound. John McCain doesn't think 47 million people without health insurance is a crisis. John McCain wants to privatize Social Security, and in 2008, he still thinks it's okay when women don't earn equal pay for equal work. Now, with an agenda like that, it makes perfect sense that George Bush and John McCain we'll be together next week in the Twin Cities, because these days they're awfully hard to tell apart.
I thought that was pretty clever, Dora. Twin Cities really is working for Hillary Clinton there. Yeah.
Well, it was certainly a catchy phrase. And Andrea, you talked this week about how Hillary Clinton till now has perhaps sent some conflicting messages to her supporters. It seemed her speech was really unequivocal. She sounded strong. She looked rested, the most rested I think we've seen her in several months. And her message seemed abundantly clear.
It's kind of amazing. She just sort of seems to never age. She looks very well-preserved. Something that was very interesting about her speech last night is that, you know, she went out and she campaigned all of those months, and we all heard her say all of those things about Barack Obama, about his experience, about his readiness to be commander-in-chief. And last night she gave this, she started testifying almost for Barack Obama and gave this very personal story about how he had started out as this organizer in Chicago. And, you know, as we were talking about yesterday, Monday night, we heard so much about his biography, but hearing it come out of Hillary Clinton's mouth saying, you should trust this man. And once again, this next clip is directed right at the downwardly mobile lower-income voters that have sort of gathered around her in this campaign.
And when Barack Obama is in the White House, he'll revitalize our economy, defend the working people of America, and meet the global challenges of our time. Democrats know how to do this. As I recall, we did it before with President Clinton and the Democrats.
So at this moment in the speech, the cameras start to turn to Bill Clinton, who's in the crowd, and people start to look at Bill Clinton. And she had this way of linking Bill Clinton and Barack Obama in a way that she'd obviously never done before. And I'm not sure that Barack Obama necessarily wanted her to do. But when she, this was one of the first times she said President Obama, and people got really excited.
Although,
and
then you know, it gets a little Kremlin-esque at this point. I mean, it's so scripted and so little. You know, look at the eyebrow move there. I mean, this is the point where I kind of feel like the conventions are just so much scripted pageantry and so little about content. What do you think the ratings are going to be for these things?
Well, clearly they're about scripted pageantry. I mean, my guess is that a lot of people were watching last night because people understand that there's this current of tension between them. This last clip, Hillary Clinton whipped the crowd up, and this was maybe 3 or 4 minutes from the end of her speech, but after she began to talk about Harriet Tubman, they stood up and they never sat down, and she sort of foreshadowed what she seems coming in this campaign, and this is the sort of final kind of emotional climax of the speech.
On that path to freedom, Harriet Tubman had one piece of advice. If you hear the dogs, keep going. If you see the torches in the woods, keep going. If they're shouting after you, keep going. Don't ever stop. Keep going. If you want a taste of freedom, keep going.
Well, and this was the moment where she sort of linked her campaign with Barack Obama's campaign.
And you're going to keep going there in Denver, I gather.
What's an obomelet?
Thank you. It's what we're having for breakfast, Andrea. Thank you very much for being with
us. We'll save you one, Andrea.
Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein in Denver at the convention with The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, August 27th. Our very favorite John Hockenberry is back. Welcome
thank you.
Back, John.
Thank you.
What'd you do, by the way?
I was in Idaho, actually, up in the mountains. I was working on a writer's conference out there. It was very, very interesting. Actually, Richard Holbrooke showed up right after he was on the program talking to you.
Yes, he did.
And the rest of the time was just fun in the mountains.
Fun in the mountains.
Relaxing.
Maybe that's our
very
takeaway
nice.
Today. Yeah. Try that at home, folks. Having fun in the mountains.
Have fun.
Well, you just asked an interesting question a moment ago about how many people are actually watching the convention, the Democratic convention there in Denver. And it's somewhere around 20 million, according to the most recent ratings, which is exactly half, John, of the 40 million people who watched Michael Phelps win his 8th gold medal at the Beijing Olympics. Anyway, wanted to pass that on.
Phelps beats Hillary.
Yes.
But we knew that.
Yeah, well, this is for Monday night, actually. Phelps beat Michelle Obama.
There you go.
Right.
Well, you know, again, conventions are not my thing. I actually loathe conventions.
I think they're fascinating.
God, they make me ill. But you know, somebody needs to love them and somebody needs to hate them. And they are.
I would be the lover and you would be the hater.
They do
just
deliver.
So we're clear.
They do deliver. I prefer to the old days when you didn't know what was going to happen at the convention. But anyway, they do
suspense.
Deliver a political message.
Yeah, there was no suspense. Anyhow, we're going to continue our conversation about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina with just 2 days until the third anniversary. Tens of thousands of people from along the Gulf are still displaced or homeless, many who would like to go home. Vincent Wilson, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're one of those people, right? You'd like to go home to New Orleans.
Yes, I am a survivor of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and the most devastating disaster, man-made disaster in the country's history.
You're speaking of the levee break. Vincent Wilson is the executive director of the Disaster Survivors Association. And you've been stranded, as you describe it, in Houston?
Yes, we're here on the island of Houston in America, stranded as castaways from our beloved New Orleans, Louisiana.
Now, tell us about your home in New Orleans.
Well, our home in New Orleans is a great home. We love it regardless. However, let me make myself perfectly clear that New Orleans, Louisiana was not without any blemishes, and we have to take onus to that. We were in a state of stagnation and decline, as many Gulf Coast states are. Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, President Carter has spoke on these issues coming up to the convention in regards to how after and before the disaster, some of these states, our states here in America, reminded them of third world countries, being that the education and the disparities thereof, the economics and the social services are just totally behind times.
Let's talk about right now and how hard is it for you to get home? Tell us about some of the obstacles you face.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. There's many of us here in the diaspora that are totally stranded. I mean, you know, we're picking ourselves up by the bootstraps, doing what we have to do, but it just resonates with inside of our taste buds to get back as soon as possible, if we can. And many of us are losing hope, and it's
are
becoming
you feeling
like
hope? Are you feeling hopeless?
Well, I mean, it feels like a distant goal now. You know, I mean, it was foremost and up front, but now, you know, you're dealing with the everyday issues of just surviving. No one's talking about how issue number one is affecting the disaster survivors, and it's getting to critical mass.
Try to explain that to us from your personal experience. What are the hurdles that you are facing in making your way home to New Orleans?
Well, I had to take on two jobs. My wife was working, okay? So I'm working basically 24 hours in addition to trying to run a nonprofit as well as a home-based business. And, you know, and it's still not enough, okay? And, you know, it's the cost of living here in Texas is totally different. You know, the whole atmosphere and environment is totally different than what we're accustomed to even 3 years after the fact. I mean, granted, you know, we made the transition. We amalgamated the best we could. And it's still an everyday struggle. Case in point, the fact that I had to take three jobs is one, and
right.
And the fact that you know we don't have the network, the extended family, the extended community that we're familiar with. We don't know anyone here. And, you know, 3 years after the fact, you know, I live in a subdivision where it's totally diverse. It's like, 20% Hispanic, maybe 3% African American.
So it really was a cultural, as well as all the other troubles you faced, it was really a different culture that you had to deal with. But tell us about all of the people. You've helped 2,500 people get home.
Absolutely. Let me just read you a letter here from Robert Eccles, who is the county judge here in Harris County, Houston, Texas, wrote to our organization, "Dear Mr. Wilson, I am pleased to support Disaster Survivors Association's application to the Corporation for National Service Texas State Program for AmeriCorps VISTA members to assist with your activities. Disaster Survivors Association is to be commended on its mission of helping survivors of disasters to regain stability and self-sufficiency. Since the inception of DSA early this year, the organization has completed an impressive list of accomplishments. I understand that the requested AmeriCorps VISTA members will be involved with the administrative training and advocacy of outreach aspects
of
four DSA projects. I urge the AmeriCorps VISTA project reviewers to give your proposal every consideration," and is signed by the county judge, Robert Eccles.
And so you've been acknowledged for helping many people get back. Vincent Williams, we appreciate your time.
Vincent Wilson, thank you.
You're welcome. Vincent Wilson is a former New Orleans resident and executive director of Disaster Survivors Association.
And there are thousands of survivors that remain, as he called it, in the island of Houston, castaways.
Many, many thousands all over the country, I should say, rather. Right now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us. Femi?
Thanks, Adore. Coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Hillary Clinton urged her supporters to get behind Barack Obama in a speech at the Democratic Convention last night. Although she acknowledged John McCain as a friend, she said that a McCain presidency would mean four more years of the same policies. British Foreign Secretary David Miliband is in Ukraine for meetings with top officials. He's trying to build a coalition against what he calls Russian aggression in nearby Georgia. Hijackers who commanded a Sudanese airliner and forced it to land in Libya are releasing the nearly 100 passengers aboard the plane unharmed. They are still holding the crew. No word on why the men hijacked the plane yet. Hurricane Gustav has become a tropical storm, Gustav, but forecasters say it could be back at hurricane status later today. Gustav pounded Haiti with torrential rains yesterday, and a storm triggered landslides that killed one person. And riot police in Thailand are clashing with protesters who took over the Prime Minister's compound yesterday. And demonstrators are complaining that the Prime Minister is just a proxy.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Of course, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we've been talking about the delicate choreography at the Democratic National Convention in Denver between the Clintons and Barack Obama. But there's some even more delicate choreography that will take place next week in the Twin Cities of Minnesota as President Bush and John McCain get together at the Republican Convention. How will Bush and McCain get together, if at all? How will the Bush administration go down in history? It's a delicate piece of choreography and a very big piece of history. And contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, Peter Baker, has spent months posing the question and compiling interviews of President Bush's former and current campaign advisors, aides, even Bush Sr., for a piece all about the Bush legacy. His piece, The Final Days, appears in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Joining us from Washington, Peter Baker, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
You know, you describe something called Bush World in your piece, which is absolutely fascinating. And it describes a sort of inner circle of people in the Bush administration who are quietly and in some cases intently thinking about legacy. Who is Bush World these days?
Well, Bush World obviously extends beyond just the White House itself to the people who think of Bush as, you know, as their as their leader, in effect. I mean, it extends from Karl Rove to Dan Bartlett, people who were aides in the White House in the past, to the president's friends in Texas, people who are now leading the effort to create a new library for him at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And, you know, these are people who very much want to do what they can to define President Bush's legacy in the terms most acceptable to him.
Is there consensus? I mean, did you find consensus? And most particularly, how is the president himself dealing with this issue?
Well, you know, what he would tell you if you were to ask him and he were to come on your program, he would say that he's not thinking about his legacy. He's sprinting to the finish. He's taking advantage of every moment he has left in office. But if you actually listen to his speeches and interviews these days, you hear more and more creeping into his conversation. You know, he's more willing to give his definition of how he sees himself in history, which is as somebody who took on tough challenges, didn't flinch in the face of pressure, even if the public was against the things he thought were right. He stood up for principle, in his view. Now, you know, obviously there's another narrative there, one of a president who didn't succeed and who's left the country in a tough position. You know, and we won't really know the answer to that for, you know, quite a while. We've seen over time many presidents' place in history change by the year, by the decade, as events sort of refocus and put their events and their administrations through a different prism.
Yeah, well, certainly. But in your piece, you describe some very interesting changes going on in emphasis and in going off script in presidential appearances that does seem to suggest something's going on.
Well, he's getting a little wistful as time draws nearer. You know, a president who doesn't like to ever deviate from the very meticulous schedule they come up with lately has been more willing to, like, you know, stop the motorcade, and if you see the lemonade stand outside of a fundraiser, he's been more a little bit more reflective. He's not a very introspective fella, he would tell you, but he's been a little bit more reflective in some of his talks to fundraisers and interviewers and so forth. And you even aides say that they see the beginning of somebody who sort of sees the end in sight. One friend told me he detects the president's Texas accent coming back into his voice a little bit as he begins to imagine life in Dallas coming up in just 5 months.
What surprised you about the people around him and what they would share with you regarding this concern for legacy or even the complications with John McCain?
Well, in terms of legacy, what's interesting is you talk to a lot of people who are close to the president. They all feel better these days about what's happening in Iraq. They feel like the president's decision to send more troops a year and a half ago has been vindicated. And yet there's sort of this sense of what if among a lot of these people. What if we had changed strategy earlier? What if we had dumped Rumsfeld earlier? What if we had sent more troops earlier? What if we had prevented Iraq from getting as bad as it got? Would that have changed not just things for Iraq, but things for the Bush administration in a broader way? Had Iraq not been so devastating, had not been so bad through 2005 and 2006, could President Bush have gotten other things done? Could he have had more success in pushing legislation on Social Security or immigration or tax reform, things that he really cared about, things that went nowhere, at least in part because the country was so sour about the war.
Peter, you make a really interesting point when you say that he's arguably the most disliked president in seven decades, according to the polls. But you also report that some of his closest aides say perhaps there's license in that, in him not having to care so much about where public opinion is.
Well, that's right. It's not just that he's unpopular. It's that he has been down for so long at this point that I think that they've become sort of inured to it, you know. He has been under 50% in the polls for, you know, his entire second term. No president has ever, you know, gone so long, so far, so down. And I think at a certain point it became sort of like, okay, there's nothing to do about it. So let's just do what we think is the right thing to do, regardless of the polls, even maybe a badge of honor to some extent, because President Bush looks at leadership, I think, as a test, as a trial. And to be a great leader is someone to have overcome great adversity, and in some fashion, this low public standing is...
Peter, really quickly, Bush's dad spoke about this. What did Bush 41 say about this persistent downturn?
Well, that's right. I asked him about this once at a little event up at Kennebunkport, and he said, you know, we talked about how his place in history had changed somewhat, obviously, in the 15 years since he's been out of office, and did that have any lessons for his son? He said he thought it does, but he doesn't talk about that with the current...
They're very circumspect, and they're definitely waiting for the verdict of history. Peter Baker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Peter Baker, contributing writer for New York Times Magazine. His piece, The Final Days, is the cover story this Sunday in the magazine. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Hillary Clinton says, and I quote, she's a proud supporter of Barack Obama. And that seemed to please the thousands of Democrats who roared with applause at the Denver convention. Senator Obama is set to be formally nominated at the Democratic convention tonight. The U.S. military has decided not to try to take a ship carrying aid into the Georgian port of Poti. The port was occupied and reportedly damaged by Russian forces early in the conflict, and they still have checkpoints on the outskirts. The FBI is investigating more than $12,000 in phone calls made when a hacker broke into FEMA's voicemail system. The hacker made more than 400 telephone calls to places like Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, India, and Yemen. And one security expert says that this type of old-school hacking was popular 10 to 15 years ago. And oil companies are preparing in the Gulf of Mexico for Gustav. Gustav is currently down to tropical storm status, but forecasters say by later today it could be a hurricane again. And just rewind 3 years ago, we were watching Katrina actually move into the Gulf area as well. So very sensitive time of the year, of course. Let's look at your news.
And it's affecting oil prices. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Now, if you were standing maybe later this afternoon on the corner of Bourbon Street and Canal in the French Quarter in New Orleans, you just might hear this version of the famous Jackson 5 tune, One More Chance. Of course, the tune's familiar, but the sound is brass and very familiar to anyone who's been to New Orleans.
Oh, definitely.
It's the brass band sound. It's relentlessly optimistic, totally New Orleans. You hear these at funerals, you hear them all over the place. And, I mean, you know this sound pretty well.
Oh, you can't miss it because it's such a point of pride in New Orleans. As you said, funerals, birthday celebrations, graduation celebrations, or just celebrating life. It is such a traditional part of the fabric of the city.
Well, like everything else in New Orleans, the brass band sound was both affected by Katrina and it's now coming back 3 years after Hurricane Katrina caused some brass bands to go into history for good. But the to-be-continued brass band, which you're hearing here, believes music is raising all the troubled boats in the struggling city of New Orleans. The band has got its old corner back, even. Saxophonist Brandon Franklin is pretty happy about it.
All
The people of New Orleans are enjoying this return. Tuba player Jason Flack says music is bringing the city back.
Brass bands. To be honest with you, that is what's going to bring people back.
Jason is speaking there in a just-released documentary called From the Mouthpiece on Back. It's a film about the struggles of the 2P continued band after Hurricane Katrina hit.
New Orleans, we lost a lot of history during the storm. We don't have that many older cats left, and if younger cats like us with the brass bands coming out, if we just throw that away, It's like we're going to be losing a lot of the history.
The brass bands and their sometimes somber but always joyful soundtrack are the backdrop to New Orleans' struggles these past years and 3 years, and they're a welcome return. Even though, as saxophonist Brandon Franklin explains, the pre-Katrina moments, the not long ago old days, are always in mind.
The last day I played with the band was on a Saturday, the day before Katrina hit. You could actually see the skies getting dark out there, you know, as we was playing. You know, but we thought it was just some rain, you know. That last day, I missed that last day. I really want to go back to that last day because that, you know, last memory we have of being together, you know. When that city was blowing.
Going back to the last day, memory in music from the 2B Continued Brass Band, one of many of the brass bands of New Orleans, coming back 3 years after Hurricane Katrina. Makes you want to dance.
It does, and all those young men taking the helm.
Yeah, and then the parades, and they got their corners back, and they're going around the French Quarter. And, you know, the accompaniment of New Orleans is coming back, just like the city's slow return, which we've been talking about all week here.
Yeah, no question. And it's so interesting. It's the next generation who are really taking charge. You can check out the TBC link on our website at thetakeaway.org and our friend feed page.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's time for some headlines from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Last night in Denver, Hillary Clinton told Democrats it's time to get behind Barack Obama in an effort to build party unity. She told delegates that whether they voted for her or for Barack Obama in the primaries, they must join together to defeat John McCain. In Afghanistan, more than 30 Taliban fighters and 4 policemen have been killed in a series of clashes, airstrikes and bombings yesterday. The Taliban fighters attacked a police checkpoint in the Nad Ali district of the southern Helmand province. The group who've hijacked a Sudanese passenger plane are demanding that it be refueled so they can fly to Paris. The aircraft is now at the remote Libyan town of Kufra. The Boeing 737 was hijacked yesterday en route from the south of the Darfur region to the capital of Khartoum, and all of the nearly 100 passengers have been released. The Federal Aviation Administration is being criticised for an electronic communication glitch that delayed hundreds of flights yesterday. The Northeast was hardest hit because of the software problem at a facility in Georgia where the flight plans are processed. Meanwhile, back in Denver this week, even the candy has political affiliations. In a downtown drugstore, there are peppermints being sold with a picture of Barack Obama and the little blurb that goes with it. Peppermints we can believe in. And at the tattered cover bookstore, there are indictments featuring Vice President Cheney and Karl Rove. And also there are peach-flavoured mints called impeachments. I look forward to bringing you Republican confectionery next week.
You can eat the indictments. That's right.
Yes, you can. Peach-flavoured mints.
Peach-flavoured mints.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome, John.
Well, as you've heard, we've been following and recapping the latest from the Democratic Convention all morning. Earlier, we talked with our political correspondent, Andrea Bernstein, about the Hillary Clinton speech last night. But Rick gave a call to 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us to give her a break.
Hi, this is Rick from New York. This morning's report on Hillary's speech last night really was very condescending. I mean, she did what she was supposed to do. What more did you expect of her? And it's time to bring this to an end so the party can get united and move on. Thank you.
Let's end America's long national nightmare. What's your take on the convention? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
And, John, we're going to keep on going with the convention because it's not just about the speeches, as our friend pointed out. It's about the networking and maneuverings behind the scenes and after hours, which is where we sent Takeaway contributor and Essence magazine editor Patrick Henry Bass, along with Takeaway convention correspondent Faith Saley, to see what's happening. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Faith, let's start with you. Give us your impression so far of the convention and what's happening behind the scenes.
Well, Adora, I should set the stage. We're talking to you from room 111 at the beautiful La Quinta Inn. And I would like Patrick to tell you what I'm wearing.
Oh, it's a button that says, I love black people.
Obama 2008. It's not just a random button that says, I love black people.
And you're nowhere near the convention, right? Let's just point that out, correct?
Oh, God, no. No, we're miles and miles away.
Okay, and it was created by the McCain people, by the way.
the button was?
Yeah, I love black people.
Actually, the young woman who sold me the button, Amber, said, I asked her if any, what the ratio of white to black who were buying the button. She said no black people had bought the button because I didn't know if I could wear it. I said, is this racist? And she said, no, if I saw a black person wearing an I love white people button, I'd just run up and hug him.
I'm going to wear mine today.
Okay.
The pathetic,
all right, people,
desperate attempts at unity.
Yeah,
here.
Let's calm down. And Faith, you were actually at the speech last night where Hillary Clinton spoke. And just give us a sense of the ambiance because you were in the crowd.
Absolutely. And to tell you that I made it to the speech, and I haven't seen Patrick since we both tried to get into the arena last night I'd say it was about 7:30 p.m. So we haven't seen each other since then. I had to beg, borrow, and almost steal, well, I did, a pass that said honored guest. As press, Patrick and I were given something that said perimeter. Then you needed a pass that says arena to get into the Pepsi Center. Then to go up one level, you need a pass that says hall. And then I found a friend randomly who had an honored guest pass. So I went up to the rafters where they did not let you enter the arena to look down on Hillary Clinton and said, find a TV. So I smiled at a guard and inched my way in. And I had this amazing view of Hillary's speech from way, way, way up high. I was standing squished next to a bunch of people before the police came and yelled at us to leave. This is yelling at us during the convention.
And then you use your get out of jail free card, right?
But I said, but I love black people. Right. Patrick, and I will say, I wasn't there obviously the night before for Michelle Obama's speech, but the feeling was so electric. And I looked around and people were, I think, in equal parts jubilant, but also wistful. That's how I felt. Patrick, where were you?
I was heading out to the parking lot to find the parties. And John and Adora, I just wanted you to know I hadn't slept an ounce. And so at any moment, I can fall into a Jerry Lewis or Lou Rawls impression and ask for a tote board because I feel like I'm hosting a telethon right now.
But well, so you were out there seeing where people were schmoozing. And Patrick,
yeah, a lot of
what did you
up.
Find?
Okay, so the first thing I found was that I was banned from the Patton Boggs party.
Who is Patton Boggs?
Patton Boggs is one of the most influential lobbying firms on the planet, which means the universe. And I was just going there to get some prawns or some beef Wellington to bring back to the luxurious La Quinta, which is the Takeaway headquarters.
So clearly
they banned me from it. I was banned from a party.
They wouldn't let you in?
Clearly.
No, they said it was oversubscribed.
Clearly, our team here has such enormous clout at the convention.
That's the thing, John and Adora. That's the theme with lack of access. I was shocked that with our lofty press credentials, we couldn't get into the Pepsi Center. And then even when I went to these parties, there's velvet ropes and VIP things. I look like a party girl from the meatpacking district right now early in the morning because I still have like bar tags.
Yeah, I have my tag.
Yeah, we both look like real partiers right now.
So is everyone spending all their time navigating, just trying to get into one place or another?
Well,
are there any of these backs behind the scenes maneuverings going on?
Transportation is pretty flawed at best, I can say. But I bounced back by going to this party for the Common Good, which is an organization that Patricia Duff, who's become quite a formidable force within the Democratic Party, she has the Rolodex of life. And so last night I was in the green room with Chevy Chase. I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not. Lynn Whitfield and Lisa Edelstein, there was a party there at the Hispanic Institute, which is a part of the Colorado Museum. And it was pretty random, but everyone was in a good mood because of Hillary's speech, so people were really ready to party.
What was the reaction to Hillary's speech? Was there a lot of politics?
They were relieved, Adora. I mean, everyone felt like they were gasping, you know, holding their breath forever. And so once she delivered that speech, I felt that everyone felt that she delivered a home run. And so they were really ready to party, which I experienced at the Harold Ford Dougie Fresh party at Club Beta.
Hold on. Harold Ford.
Oh, at Club 5 Degrees, we had Moby.
Hold on. Let me just, so I can make sure I'm clear about this. Harold Ford, as in the former congressman from Tennessee, and Dougie Fresh,
the
rapper
DJ
from the 80s.
Correct. And then I found out, guys, that this party
was
actually
a little retro, guys.
It is. But then I found out this party was actually sponsored by the United Steelworkers of America, which no one ever said. You know, my cab driver told me that.
It's like, you know, cab driver's up on.
As I was going to a diner at 3 o'clock in the morning.
The sponsorship at these parties is so bizarre. At one point, I was at a party called the Rising Stars Party at Club 5 Degrees, and this was to honor some youngish electeds like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles City Council. And the DJ, no, but there was no there. There was no center. I don't know about your party, but you didn't get a sense you were there to celebrate Obama or the convention. It was just a lot of good-looking people. You could have been in New York or L.A. talking to each other, eating the prawns. And at one point, the DJ tried to get everybody together. He's like, oh, Obama. Nobody stopped. Nobody cheered. And then he said,
well, they were eating
Fiji
shrimp.
But then he says, is Fiji water in the house? Because Fiji water had sponsored the event and nobody paid him any mind.
Guys, we got to go. But what's your mission for tonight? Quickly.
To get back at Patton Boggs is my mission. I'm going to take him down, John.
You go.
I'm taking him down.
You go.
What about you, Faith? Quick.
I'm going to find an I Love White People pin. We're going to hug it out.
Have one.
All right. Well, make sure you bring us gifts back. That's all I have to.
Our listeners will make one for you. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Henry Bass, our takeaway contributor. He's a senior editor at Essence. And we also had Faith Saley, who is our takeaway convention correspondent. And they'll be back with us with more reports from Denver.
Now, we're following the Democratic Convention on our website and talking about the things that really matter, perceptions, issues, and the money that drives politics. It's all linked from our homepage at thetakeaway.org. Lots of stuff to do there.
Friday marks the 3-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and we're continuing our coverage. We're speaking to some survivors of the country's worst national disaster.
You're experiencing it. We all know about it. What have you noticed in your own food market? Food prices are going crazy. Are you changing what you eat? How about what your family eats? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And your takeaway for this hour?
I didn't know if I could wear it. I said, is this racist? And she said, no, if I saw a black person wearing an I Love White People button, I'd just run up and hug him.
Oh, great choice, guys. We'll get a lot of emails there. Also on thetakeaway.org, we're talking about the disparity between the rich and poor in industrial metropolis communities like New York City and Denver. If you missed anything, go to thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Adora. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So Ruben and Mimi Cantor, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mimi, you're in Denver for the Democratic National Convention.
Yes, we are.
And you guys have been married for how many days?
For 4 days since Sunday.
4 days. So this is technically your honeymoon.
Yes, it is.
And you're at the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, it's pretty thrilling.
It's hardcore, I'd say. Now you're at the Marriott, right?
The
Marriott Renaissance Hotel. Okay, I guess I just have to ask, since you're on your honeymoon and all that, how's that room at the Renaissance working out for you?
No complaints so far.
You doing room service this morning?
Well, my husband has to go and work the breakfast.
Oh, so Democratic special just for one room service for the Cantors?
I'm invited to the breakfast.
Very good. So no room service this morning. on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, August 27th, and he's back. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Adora. And good luck to those newlyweds, eh?
Yeah, good luck to them. And big time things happening there in Denver. And it was a big night last night for many at the Democratic convention. And today we have reaction to Senator Hillary Clinton's speech and a look forward to tonight's double hitter of speeches from former President Bill Clinton and now vice presidential candidate Joe Biden. Also, Russia, the Kremlin is backing the independence for two breakaway provinces that triggered Russia's clash with Georgia. And a food index. Just how much more are you paying for what you eat? Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
On stage at the Democratic convention last night, Hillary Clinton urged her supporters to get behind Barack Obama, but she also gave them a shout out for all their work on her campaign.
To my supporters, to my champions, to my sisterhood of the traveling pantsuits.
Coming to a bumper sticker near you, she thanks supporters for never giving up on her candidacy. Bill Clinton takes his turn at the podium tonight, and Senator Joe Biden will formally accept the Democratic nomination for vice president. Riot police in Thailand are clashing with protesters who took over the prime minister's compound yesterday. The protesters say they won't leave till the current prime minister steps down.
The British foreign secretary is in Ukraine today. He's trying to pull together a coalition against what he calls Russian aggression in nearby Georgia. Moscow provoked widespread condemnation among Western countries yesterday when it recognized the independence of two breakaway Georgian regions. The men who attacked, hijacked a Sudanese airliner and forced it to land in Libya have released the nearly 100 passengers aboard the plane unharmed. They're now demanding fuel so they can fly to Paris.
The Hurricane Gustav has been downgraded to Tropical Storm Gustav, but it's still affecting oil prices. They rose above $117 a barrel in Asian trading, the Dow up almost a quarter of a percent to 11,412. The S&P opens today at 1271. How is food price rises? How are food price rises affecting your behavior? That's what we want to know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a reporter for us. Go out, tell us the cost of staples and how it's changed your dietary behavior.
Everything's gone up. Fruit, cereal, meat, cheese. It's shocking sometimes to go into a grocery store, which I did just yesterday. So give us your story. Were you shocked? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Well, Joe Biden will officially accept the nomination of a vice presidential candidate next
no suspense
to
there.
Barack Obama
no
today. There. We're also keeping an eye on who John McCain may pick as his vice presidential candidate, and we're talking about it on our Facebook game, the Veep Stakes. Former Massachusetts governor and former presidential candidate Mitt Romney is currently a 4-1 favorite over a previous number one Minnesota governor, Tom Pawlenty. But stock prices
Tim Pawlenty.
Yes. But stock prices are rising quickly for both. And if you've been playing the game a long time, you've seen it go back and forth. Check the game out on thetakeaway.org.
There's plenty of political stuff on thetakeaway.org, by the way. We got all kinds of things going, especially if you want to design your own candidate. We have a way for you to do that. You know, Tom Pawlenty, they're actually trading in Tom Pawlenty now that you mentioned him. He didn't actually have any sort of visibility
That's
whatsoever.
Why he hasn't risen high quickly, because everyone's trading
Pawlenty
under the name Tom.
Well, we're going to go to Denver now, and there were plenty of people in the Denver Convention Hall last night who would have shrieked and moaned and cried if Hillary Clinton had stood up and simply read the Denver telephone book. But there were a lot of people in that hall who Hillary Clinton really had to convince her supporters to feel good about turning from her to her former rival and inspiring party unity to vote for Barack Obama. Some of those supporters have been slow to embrace Obama, and Chicago Public Radio's Ben Calhoun is covering the conventions for The Takeaway. Those Hillary supporters who we might call holdouts actually have a name for themselves, right, Ben?
Well, there's definitely a core group of them, and they have an acronym, PUMA, which it's been sanded down a little bit, but the original acronym stood for Party Unity My Blank. You can
My Ass. I think you can say that. Yeah. Even in public radio, you can say that.
You did, not me.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, so what? So what does that mean? Okay. Well, when you leave church, why don't you tell us the rest of what you found out about Ben?
Well,
you talked to a bunch of these people, right?
I did. I went to the PUMA headquarters, which is in this house, which is recently or currently home to a bail bond business, and it's plastered over with Hillary Clinton signs. All the furniture has been taken out. They've got a table with merchandise on it. That includes bracelets, Hillary t-shirts that say Howard Dean, I'm not coming home, things like that.
Oh, wow, that's hardcore.
Yeah. But I went there last night because I wanted to hang out with the supporters, because it seemed to me that the further and further we went down this road, the more Hillary Clinton urged people to back Barack Obama, the shakier rhetorical ground these supporters were on, because, you know, the person that they were extolling the judgment and the virtues of as a leader, they were rejecting their advice.
So tell me specifically who you talked to.
Well, there was a house full of people, about 40 to 50, I would say mostly white, mostly women. There was only a handful of men, and they had things that they would do. There were these cultural things, like there was the Puma Mobile that rolled up at one point, and everybody actually roared. But so there are a couple people I want to introduce you to. One was a woman who wouldn't give me her real name, but she went by her YouTube handle, which was Beethoven Queen. And this is what she said about what she was expecting from Hillary Clinton in her speech last night.
She's got to say this, and she's got to say that, and she's got to come out strong in support of Barack. And the media has all their you know, agendas of the things that Hillary must do. And unfortunately, I think Hillary will actually fulfill some of those things.
Given your respect for her, is there anything that she could say tonight that would change your feelings?
My feelings about what?
About the election, about Obama.
I don't want her to change my feelings about Obama.
So that was the overwhelming theme that I got back from people. And I also got it from a woman named Ginny Romer, and this is what she said to me.
You don't select a less experienced, younger, more charismatic man over the much more experienced, deserving, better leader woman and have the rest of us fall in line. I have to take a stand. I'm not going to vote for him. So I'm a Puma.
Is there anything that she could say tonight that would change your mind?
I can't think of it.
Well, there's the challenge. I mean, the gauntlet is thrown down. I mean, how did the Clinton speech test with the Puma gang? And we can actually see on the website, you in the Puma den. There's some video on our website. But how did it go over?
Well, if you watch the video, that this was a weird gathering where it was Democrats watching Fox News cheering for Sean Hannity and occasionally cheering for McCain commercials. So I just want to cut to, we had two diverging reactions here. We had from Beethoven Queen, who stuck by her guns afterwards, and this is what she said.
Her comments about Barack Obama really just they just roll off me.
Do you think that she means it when she urges people to vote for him?
I think that's a really weird question, because that question is questioning her sincerity. Like, is she being a fake or is she being a fraud? It's kind of like you're asking me that. And I think that you have to give Hillary enough respect that when she says things, you just have to believe that she means it.
So does it affect you that she means it, that she wants people to vote for Barack Obama?
You keep kind of coming back to this question, like, what would, like, does it, like, kind of like, can Hillary persuade me to vote for Barack? I think that's your question. No, Hillary can't persuade me to vote for Barack.
Yeah, that was your question, Ben Calhoun from the mainstream media. You evildoer. You know, Ben, we're going to have to go at this point, but, you know, we want to hear more from you and talking to these people, because really that core constituency and their persuasion by what happens at this convention is crucial to the campaign. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ben Calhoun, reporter for Chicago Public Radio at the Denver Convention for us. Adora?
John, today Britain's foreign minister is headed to Ukraine, attempting to build a coalition against what he's called Russian aggression, and that's referring to the Russian military incursion into another former Soviet state, Georgia. Ukraine's president, Viktor Yushchenko, who, like Georgian leaders, wants to join NATO, has described his country as being held hostage by Russia. Now, this trip is happening on a day after Moscow recognized two breakaway Georgian regions, including South Ossetia and Abkhazia, as independent states, which President Bush called an irresponsible decision. Joining us for more is Gabriel Gatehouse from our partner, the BBC. And welcome, Gabriel. President Bush called it irresponsible, but he didn't announce any consequences.
No, that's right. I mean, we've seen a lot of strong rhetoric flitting backwards and forwards between Moscow and Washington over Georgia, especially over this issue of recognizing South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Washington, George Bush, has been very strong in its support of the Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, in saying that Georgia's territorial integrity is not up for negotiation. But you're right. Actually, I think the strongest reaction we've seen, apart from the Georgians themselves, is the British Foreign Secretary, who's now flown to Kiev to build what he calls a coalition against Russian aggression. These are very, very strong words. So strong, in fact, that even the Ukrainian president's website is trying to tone it down a bit, saying that they're going to talk about humanitarian assistance to Georgia and about strengthening international institutions, but not mentioning anything like Russian aggression. The situation on the ground remains that the Russians are very much calling the shots, certainly militarily here, and there's very little that anyone can do about that at the moment.
Now, was Foreign Minister David Miliband, was his trip scheduled, and what do you think his goal is in going there?
Well, I think David Miliband wants to show himself to be a strong leader on this, taking the lead in confronting what he sees as Russia's actions, which many believe to be illegal and certainly damaging to the stability of the region. Certainly, that's what NATO partners are saying. Certainly, that's what the Georgian government rather is saying. I think David Miliband wants to be seen to be taking the lead, and I think many NATO allies are acutely aware that the realities on the ground are that, as I say, there's not much that they can do militarily. Georgia was quite thoroughly defeated by the Russian army in South Ossetia. The South Ossetian militia, backed by Russian forces, now very much control things on the ground. So I think the push from now on is going to be diplomatic. And I think Britain, under David Miliband, wants to be seen to be taking the lead on that, while at the same time the United States, of course, is providing this military humanitarian aid mission, but led by the military, where we see U.S. Navy and Coast Guard vessels docking in Georgian ports on the Black Sea.
Gabriel Gatehouse, thanks very much for that update. Gabriel Gatehouse is a reporter for our partner, the BBC, and he was coming to us from Tbilisi in Georgia.
Finally,
right in the heart of things.
Actual news story, unlike what's going on in Denver. I mean, that's really, really serious Cold War
rhetoric. But it's the news itself of what's not happening as well as what is happening in Denver. That would be considered news.
Well, I just think that the idea that Ukraine over the Crimea might be in another conflict with Russia at this point, while the shenanigans is going on in Denver, is a huge, huge story.
And we're going to investigate further exactly what's happening in that region and what perhaps is in the minds of Russian leaders as they ratchet up the rhetoric and followed by some military action in Georgia.
Diplomacy or a 21st century Crimean war? On The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. This morning, John and I are wondering, and yes, I'm speaking for him, we're wondering about how much that food
That's
on
okay.
your table...
That's okay. Go right ahead.
How much that food on your table... is costing, right? We've been talking about food this morning. We're also following the latest from the Democratic Convention and Hillary Clinton's speech last night. And so is Sonia from Glens Bay, New York.
I thought the Hillary Clinton speech was phenomenal. I'm a Hillary supporter. I never would have voted for Obama without hearing what she had to say. And now I'm supporting Obama. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. And what did you think of the speech? Call in with your take, and you can call us on a toll-free number, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Well, certainly ever since the 2000 election, political junkies have been obsessed with maps, particularly the blue state, red state map, with also the swing states, and there are even blue county, red county maps. But there are many different ways of dividing up the United States. And one project of the Christian Science Monitor called Patchwork Nation is something we've been checking in with. And joining us is the head of the project, Dante Cheney. He's in Denver for the DNC. Dante, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Now, explain how the Patchwork Nation map works and how it might be different from the red state, blue state map.
Well, you know, the red state, blue state map, or even red county, blue county map, those are maps that look at how the presidential vote went, essentially, to tell you what kind of place that is. And we just thought that's not adequate. So what we did is, you know, we've mapped the nation county by county, but what we've done is we've cross-referenced reams of census and consumer data to identify 11 different kinds of place, 11 different kinds of county in America.
And so we're not talking about geographic proximity. We're talking about economic and, other kinds of similarities, and you put them all together. And today we're going to talk about something called the industrial metropolis. What does that subdivision look like?
Well, there's only 24 counties in the United States that we call industrial metropolis, but they hold 38 million people. They basically hold the nation's biggest cities. They're the most diverse places. You know, they're basically the nation's kind of big urban mixing pots.
And in the industrial metropolis community, which includes New York, San Francisco, mm-hmm. even Denver, what political proclivities, I suspect probably a favoring of the Democratic Party in these places, but what did you find?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, by far, these are the places that are the strongest Democratic strongholds around the country. Of the 11 groups, this is the Democratic vote here goes the vote here goes heavily, heavily Democratic. Absolutely, yeah.
What's in play here, if there is anything that might be going Republican in a surprising way, and how do the industrial metropolis votes maybe trump other districts in states that would have electoral significance, because the Electoral College, of course, is the only real calculation here in the end.
Well, yeah, but the way these things work, though, is, you know, a state ultimately tips one way or the other by, you know, you've got to win a state. And so you'd say that these industrial metropolis places do go Democratic, but the question is by what margins? And these are big, diverse places, so they're not, you know, they have, and there's a lot of Democrats there, but there are Barack Obama supporters, say, and there are Hillary Clinton supporters. There's a lot of issues at play. And if the margins aren't big enough for Obama in some of these places, especially in states like, with Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and Cleveland and Ohio and Denver out in Colorado, they could tip the state the other way.
Well, then, is in industrial metropolis America, is it the economy stupid?
I'll tell you, every place we've been, it's the economy stupid. There's no question. But beyond that, the big issues in these cities, are crime. Crime's a big issue. I mean, Philly had a big crime problem earlier this year. Even Denver earlier this summer had some problems with gun violence. And then the other thing you see here is this is really where the income disparities of America come into sharp focus. These are the places of rich. There are more people making over $100,000 a year here than any other community we look at. And also very high poverty rates as well. These are the big cities. They're a little bit like, the country's third world nations. They've got a lot of poor and a lot of rich.
Well, before we go, remind people how they can go to our election website at thetakeaway.org and see exactly the kinds of Patchwork Nation maps that you've created. Take us through it.
Well, right now we're at your site on your billion-dollar president, I believe, you're giving us some nice coverage there, looking at what's going on our site.
But we can go to Patchwork Nation, and what is it that we can see, and how can we sort of explore ourselves the kinds of interesting things that you're discovering?
Oh, well, if you go to Patchwork Nation, also we have all the community types listed there. And you can look at each type of community, see how they're mapped. There's a big map on the front of the site that kind of shows the best match for every county in America. But if you look at each individual community type page, you kind of see the more nuanced pictures. You can look at the demographic profiles of these places and kind of those. There are maps in those pages that kind of show different shades,
So I can find my own county and then see what other counties are absolutely similar to mine in the categories that you've created.
Absolutely. You can put in your zip code, and it'll tell you what kind of county type you live in. And actually, you can take a survey, and it'll tell you how well you match that county in terms of your demographic profile and some of your beliefs.
Well, it's called Patchwork Nation, and you can read more of Dante's insights about the unique issues in the Patchwork Nation communities, of course, on our election website, thetakeaway.org. Dante Cini, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
From the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. And no patches on her very, very smart jacket this morning. Femi Oke has the headlines.
Yeah, I can see you've been working on your slinky links while you were on vacation.
Cleverington here.
Oh, goodness me. We missed you. Good morning. It is 28 minutes past the hour. There's a thunder lightning bolt coming down here for me lying. Hillary Clinton's message to her supporters at the Democratic convention last night was reject McCain and get behind Obama. She said that Obama has the right policies to move the country forward, and Senator Clinton got a standing ovation. Potential running mates for John McCain are on the attack against Barack Obama. The Republicans have set up a war room close to the Denver convention. Yesterday, Mitt Romney was in Denver talking about his concern with an Obama presidency.
His experience has not provided for him the kind of judgment and gravitas that's necessary to face the challenges in the world at large, and more directly today, the challenges at home.
Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, who's believed to be a top contender, is set to play attack dog in Denver on Thursday. And earlier this week, Rudy Giuliani was on duty. The British Foreign Secretary is in Ukraine today. He's meeting with top leaders in Kiev to form a coalition against Russian aggression in nearby Georgia. The Ukrainian president has condemned the recent Russian military incursion into Georgia. He says it's affecting Ukrainian security. And an American warship loaded with humanitarian supplies, has docked at the Georgian port city of Batumi today. The U.S. has issued contradictory statements about where the ship was headed. One report had the ship docking at Poti, a city controlled by Russian forces, but now the U.S. embassy says the vessel was headed for Batumi all along. The standoff inside the prime minister's compound in Thailand continues today. Riot police have stormed the compound overnight to kick out protesters who took over the building yesterday. And that's a look at your international and domestic news headlines for now.
And Gustav's been downgraded to a tropical storm.
It has. But once it gets over water, it'll get back again. You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Sure, you see food prices rising where you are, but how do you take the food price pulse of the entire world? The BBC's Food Price Watch is price-checking actual grocery shelves all over the world. But we want you to tell us, is cooking with meat and potatoes costing you more? What is the impact on you of higher food prices? One of our listeners wrote in to say, the high cost of fuel has made us adapt more sensibly to driving habits. Perhaps in a similar way, high food prices will result in more healthy eating habits, as in more vegetables, more home cooking, and less processed food. What's your story? You can call us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE.
And, John, we're moving on to Russia. They're at it again. Russia continued to stoke international tensions by backing its parliament and formally recognizing the Georgian separatist regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent states. Now, the move, not surprisingly, exacerbated tensions with Western world leaders who have already grown increasingly frustrated with Russia's hawkish posturing. Joining us now for more is Edward Lucas. He is the Central and Eastern Europe correspondent for The Economist and the author of The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Welcome, Edward.
Nice to be on your show. Good morning.
Now, given the already heightened tensions, what message do you think the Kremlin is sending?
I think the main
message the Kremlin is sending is what one might call mind over matter. We don't mind and you don't matter. They feel that the West doesn't have the willpower to resist them and they can really do what they want. They've got $600 billion in the bank in their hard currency reserves and they see that Europe is divided and among itself and that Europe and America are not united and they don't feel any pressure from us that matters. The Russian population is very strongly behind what they're doing, thanks to the strong control of the media inside Russia. And so I think we can regard this only as the overture to an extremely bleak and tragic three-act opera, which is going to play out in the coming years.
Now, there was some talk. What happened to the talk last week after Russia's parliament backed acknowledging the independence of the two breakaways? That Russia, the Kremlin, was going to wait and see how the West was reacting, given the tensions following Russia's move into Georgia, that perhaps they were going to step back a little bit.
Well, I think they looked to see how the West was reacting and decided that we weren't reacting. I mean, we've seen our ally dismembered before our eyes. We've seen Russian troops and their freebooters, their irregular allies, looting, raping, burning, blowing things up all over Georgia. And the West response has been pretty weak, really. We have seen cross statements, but words are not nearly as important as deeds.
What options do they have, that being the West?
I think there's lots of things we can do, and some of them won't work for some time because we should have done them a long time ago. But for a start, we should make it absolutely clear immediately that Russia is no longer welcome at meetings of the G7. That would be the first thing. We should suspend Russia's membership of the Council of Europe, which is a rather meaningless but symbolically important body that meets in Strasbourg, which is the sort of custodian of the continent's human rights legislation. We should say with very clearly that Russia is not going to join the World Trade Organization or the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which are the two big international clubs to which they don't yet belong.
Well, I don't know, Edward. You know, it's beginning to feel with these two stories, and now the Ukraine is even involved, that, you know, we're spending a bit of, like, you know, Napoleon's cold winter of 1812 as far as Moscow is concerned. There aren't really a lot of options, and I'm just wondering if with the foreign minister now in Ukraine from Britain, is there any conceivable possibility that the same kind of thing might erupt over the Crimea, the territory in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think they will get what they want in Ukraine either by using the Crimea to humiliate Ukraine sort of Georgian style, or maybe just through the electoral cycle, because elections are coming up in Ukraine and the pro-Western camp is looking pretty discredited now. We didn't support them when we could have had a chance of making a difference, and so it may well be they get a friendly government in Kiev just voted in the course of events in the next few weeks, and that will also, I fear, is going to happen in Lithuania as well, where the pro-Kremlin party is arriving.
But let's back up before we start thinking about what might happen down the road. At some point, aren't Russia's moves reined in or constrained a bit by the country's need to be a member of the international economic community? You just talked about the $6 billion that they have in the bank.
$600 billion
they have in the bank, but don't they need to continue making money?
Well, they used to be much more dependent on Western capital markets than they are now. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, it was a really big deal to get a listing in New York or London. And so we had the chance then, which we didn't take, to apply some pressure. But now, if we make life difficult for them in the Western financial system, they can move to elsewhere. And the Russians like to say we have Dubai, Mumbai, and Shanghai, and they are big stock markets. We'll list our stocks and bonds there, and we don't have to worry so much about Frankfurt, London, and New York. So I think as the economic center of gravity shifts south and east, this is very good news for the Russians. I think, actually, you were asking earlier, what can we do? One thing we can do is go after their assets in Western countries, particularly the funny companies and phony trading outfits that are owned by the top people in the Kremlin.
Funny? Why do you call them funny?
Phony.
Oh, phony.
There's an oil trading company here. I better not mention by name on air because I can be sued in Britain even for things I say on an American radio station. But there's an oil trading company based in Switzerland which has managed to become the largest oil trading company in Europe by getting oil cheap from Russia and selling it at world prices. And insofar as we can see who owns it, it goes right back, right to the very top of the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this company is allowed to operate in Switzerland. It uses Western banks. It has Western auditors. It's treated as a respectable company.
So in other words, there's a very, it's almost octopus-like in terms of how Russia has created a stand for itself as it moves forward. Edward Lucas, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Edward Lucas, Central and Eastern Europe correspondent for The Economist and the author of The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Now returning to Femi Okeh because she's got some headlines for us.
Thanks very much, Adora. Thai police are surrounding the compound around the Prime Minister's office that's been taken over by anti-government demonstrators. A court has issued warrants for the arrest of several of the protest leaders. In southern Mississippi, federal officials say that nearly 600 suspected illegal immigrants were detained in a raid on a manufacturing plant. It was the largest such sweep in the country. The Gang of 10 is now the Gang of 16. That's six more senators, three Democrats and three Republicans. They've joined a bipartisan group to support a bill they say will break the stalemate over offshore drilling in Congress. The group supports a bill that would lift a ban on oil and natural gas drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico and off the southeastern United States. And we were just talking about Russia with Edward Lucas from The Economist. And Russia is holding the party line when it concerns North Korea. It is urging North Korea to reconsider its decision to halt the dismantling of its nuclear facilities. And that's a look at your international and domestic headlines for now.
Russian influence looming in East Asia as well. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Last night in Denver, Senator Hillary Clinton was met by a standing ovation as she made her way to the podium in a speech that many have been waiting for at the Democratic convention. It really was, John, as you've noted, an important speech as Democrats work to unite this week, while some of her supporters are finding it hard to back her former rival, Senator Barack Obama. 26 words in, she made it clear who she's supporting.
As a proud mother, as a proud Democrat, as a proud senator from New York, a proud American, and a proud supporter of Barack Obama. My friends, it is time to take back the country we love.
It was an historic speech. I mean, her accomplishments are historic. The first woman to rack up primary wins in 22 states, pulling in roughly 18 million votes. And she had a challenge for all of those voters who supported her.
I want you to ask yourselves, were you in this campaign just for me? Or were you in it for that young Marine and others like him? Were you in it for that mom struggling with cancer while raising her kids? Were you in it for that young boy and his mom surviving on the minimum wage? Were you in it for all the people in this country who feel invisible?
It was part cheerleading, part stump speech, part attacking the Republicans.
John McCain doesn't think 47 million people without health insurance is a crisis. John McCain wants to privatize Social Security, and in 2008, he still thinks it's okay when women don't earn equal pay for equal work. With an agenda like that, it makes perfect sense that George Bush and John McCain will be together next week in the Twin Cities, because these days they're awfully hard to tell apart.
Lastly, it was part looking to the past for inspiration.
This is the story of America, of women and men who defy the odds and never give up. So how do we give this country back to them? By following the example of a brave New Yorker, a woman who risked her lives to bring slaves to freedom along the Underground Railroad. On that path to freedom, Harriet Tubman had one piece of advice. If you hear the dogs, keep going. If you see the torches in the woods, keep going. If they're shouting after you, keep going. Don't ever stop. Keep going. If you want a taste of freedom, keep going.
Senator Hillary Clinton at the 2008 Democratic Convention.
Talking about the Republican slave owners in the John McCain campaign, apparently.
No, I don't think I would go quite that far.
Referring to Harriet Tubman.
But it was actually quite inspiring. I like that point. If you hear the dogs, just keep running.
She did a good job, that's for sure. But I'm having a Denver flashback.
To?
Well, I'm flashbacking to last night. It's a convention. Convention flashback.
Thanks, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, August 27th, we have some headlines for you from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there to your door. It is coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Last night in Denver, Hillary Clinton told Democrats it's time to get behind Barack Obama. In an effort to build party unity, she told delegates that whether they'd voted for her or for Barack Obama in the primaries, they must join together to defeat John McCain. Clinton said that 4 years of McCain would be another 4 years of Bush administration policies. The group who've hijacked a Sudanese passenger plane were demanding that it be refueled as they fly to Paris, but we've just got this news update in. The airline official says that two hijackers of the Darfur plane have surrendered. The Boeing 737 was hijacked yesterday en route from the south of the Darfur region to the capital of Khartoum, and the almost 100 passengers have already been released. The British Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, is in Ukraine today to try to build support against Russia for its recent aggression in Georgia. This follows the Russian president's announcement yesterday supporting the independence of the two breakaway Georgian regions. And Gustav is back down to tropical storm status, but forecasters say by later today it could become a hurricane again. And forecasters say that Gustav could enter the Gulf of Mexico as a major hurricane this weekend. Gustav has already dumped heavy rain across southern Haiti, and one person died in a landslide. The Federal Aviation Administration is being criticized for an electrical communication glitch that delayed hundreds of flights yesterday. The Northeast was hardest hit because of the software problem at a facility in Georgia where flights are processed. And finally, the man who wrote the book 100 Things Before You Die has died. Author Dave Freeman died after a fall at his home. He was just 47, but his family said he visited about half the places on his list. He put together the travel and guide
to
adventure. Wasn't
it 1,000? Wasn't it 1,000?
There was another book called 1,000 Places, because I don't think he lived long enough to do 500.
I'm not going there.
Very impressive.
Yeah, very impressive, yes.
But it's a good book.
Yes.
You're welcome.
We're talking food.
So you're hungry. I'm hungry. We're all hungry. And we all know that food prices are rising. And as I alluded to earlier in the hour, how do you take the pulse of food price rises throughout the world? Well, the BBC World Service has embarked upon a global experiment to see if we can find an economic indicator that would be relevant to consumers all over the world. They've been trying to see how much consumers were being affected in places all over the world. Every week, reporters from 8 cities visit the same store buying the exact same items to compare how the price of food fluctuates over time. Richard Collings is the editor of the BBC's business programs and set up the World Service Food Price Index Project, and joins us on the line from London. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John and Adora. How are you?
It's
good.
We're great. We're doing great. And actually, you know, we're actually getting a little hungry talking to you about this. How did you choose the places, and how can we be sure that something like this is actually a valid measure of the global experience of food price rises?
Well, how we chose the places, really, we were looking for different cities across the world so that people could say afterwards, this is really representative of the whole world. So we've got cities like Delhi, Jakarta being in Indonesia, Washington, D.C., Buenos Aires in South America, Brussels in Europe, Nairobi in Africa. So it really is a truly global index. Now, the problem's been in the past that lots of governments around the world release official figures of food prices, but these take about 3 or 4 months to filter through. So, say, if you're waiting for the US government or the British government to release these figures, it's going to take some time before you actually see what they think the measure of prices is. In the meantime, people are saying, hang on, the price of food has gone up this morning. I'm paying more for my milk. I'm paying more for my bread. And so we thought the best thing to do would be to tap into the BBC's reporters around the world and get them to visit the same store, the same grocery store every week, every Monday, in fact, and go in like a secret shopper, really, so they don't announce that they're coming from the BBC, just in case somebody there puts something on special offer to show that the price has gone down. What we do, we go in a secretive manner and just sort of take a note of the price, the same milk each week, the same beef each week, the same number of eggs each week.
Well, Richard, how do you account for the, you know, disparities in diet around the world? I mean, some cuisines are rice-based, some are wheat-based, corn-based. There's different levels of meat in diets, and depending on where you are in the world, how do you account for that?
That's right. Well, we started off thinking, shall we compare like with like? And as you quite rightly point out, that would be impossible because the US diet is completely different to the diet in India, for example. So for the United States, we chose bread, milk, potatoes, beef and eggs. But in places like Africa, we were local advice. People there told us that maize flour is a real staple in the diet. So they're different products in different cities around the world. But basically, we started off by taking these five staple products in every country, and we started the index off at the same base figure. I won't go into the complications about how it's calculated.
But you mathematically come up with a beginning point and then begin to have a comparison. So how many data points do you have at this point?
Well, we have five because it's been running for 5 weeks, and the beginning point was the number 100. So if you go back to sometime in the middle of July and say you look at food prices in Nairobi, that's in Kenya in Africa, started off at 100, and they've slowly risen there, and the basket of foods there that we're measuring has slowly risen to about 105. So there's obviously been some inflation there. In the US, it stayed pretty much constant. Now, there are sort of fluctuations week on week in different products. There was a big price rise in the in milk a few weeks ago.
But you're really just talking about the last 5 weeks. It's not like, say, the past year.
No, but you've got to start somewhere. So
I just wanted to be clear, because I think that so many people who are listening, like myself, know that when you go into the grocery store, you feel like you're paying a lot more for, say, eggs than you did a year ago, but not necessarily
exactly
5 weeks ago. 5 weeks ago comparison.
No, what this has thrown up is, as I say, you know, like the price of milk has risen over the last 5 weeks in the US, and over the past year, in fact, when you look at some other official figures, apparently in the US, consumers have been paying about 5% more for their food year on year.
You know, let's look at that 100 to 105 number that you described for Nairobi, is it?
That's right, for Nairobi in Kenya.
Now, does that represent a 5% increase in just 5 weeks?
It does, I'm afraid.
Wow, that actually annualized is pretty terrifying.
It is, and you know, some of these countries that we're measuring are the poorest of the poor, and we've had riots over the last few weeks in places like Indonesia because the government there is saying it's cutting back its subsidy not only on gasoline but also on food. So you know, staple food like rice would have been heavily subsidised by the government there. The government is slowly cutting back on this subsidy, so the price is rising in the shops, and we've seen some quite sort of violent protests on the streets. And I mean, you've got to remember, in a place like India, about 8 years ago, the entire government was brought down,
right,
because the price of vegetables,
sure,
rose. And so this is something, you know, that people really do sort of take to their hearts, not just in the developing world, but as we know, in the more developed world as well.
Well, Richard, we want to keep with you on this and check in from time to time. How long do you plan to continue with this? And what sorts of statistics would we be comparing your food price measures to?
Well, we hope to keep on going as long as we can, really. I mean, when we first thought about this, we thought, where can we get this data from? And as it wasn't available anywhere, and we thought the most accurate way of doing it is to send our reporters out to the shops. And so that measure, I think, is the really important thing to remember here. These are real prices which real people have to pay in the shops. These aren't government figures. And so, you know, they will affect your listeners, the rest of the BBC's listeners, everyone around the world in that sense.
And perhaps we'll have the impact of keeping some of these governments honest about the rise in food prices, which, as you point out, is a very politically sensitive issue. Richard Collings, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Richard Collings is the editor of the BBC's business programs. He joined us from Bush House in London. Very, very interesting economic indicator.
Yeah, there. And looking forward to see what he has to say next month. But for now, today on The Takeaway, the Democratic National Convention, and the latest from Denver, and a look at the gulf between the haves and the have-nots in the industrial metropolis, communities like New York and Denver.
We keep hearing about the price of food, and we were just talking about it there. We want to know what you've noticed in your own supermarket. Are you charging or changing what you eat? How about what your family eats? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
My name is Tyrone, and I'm from Baltimore, Maryland, and food prices have gone through the roof. Junk food is like the best thing to eat only because it's cheap, but the food you need to buy, like the corn, the fruits and vegetables and meats, they have shot up like crazy. Bread went from $1.39 in 1996 to $2.59 to right now. That's too much. Way too much.
And here's your takeaway for today.
Well, I think they looked to see how the West was reacting and decided that we weren't reacting. I mean, we've seen our ally dismembered before our eyes.
Edward Lucas talking about the new Cold War. It's The Takeaway.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,